I now have the arduous task of introducing Professor Norman Finkelstein, and it is difficult because there is so much to say on this man who has had a fruitful life with many accomplishments. We can all read his bibliography in his new book on Gaza and the title of this very lecture, This Time We Went Too Far, The Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. And we can easily Wikipedia, so I'm not going to go into the details of his life, but rather the important things he has accomplished. He is the author of 6 books, most of which concern the Holocaust and Israeli occupation of Palestine. He was a professor at a few different colleges and universities, most recently DePaul, which he is particularly infamous for due to his battle for tenure. Dr. Norman Finkelstein has never shied away from controversy, and many of us know him from famous clips on YouTube, from certain campus lectures, his interview on Hezbollah, all clips that went viral. Or you may have seen him on his infamous debate with Alan Dershowitz on Democracy Now!, in which he exposed Dershowitz for plagiarism. Most recently, he was detained and banned from entering Israel for another 10 years on the premise of being a so-called security threat. He has traveled to Gaza, Lebanon, and is an outspoken critic of Israeli policy. He's spoken on hundreds of campuses across the world, and now MSU is lucky enough to have Professor Norman Finkelstein on our campus, shedding light on issues that need it. His recent book on Operation Cast Lead is one of the first academic pieces of scholarship published on this issue, and is a concise yet informative and detailed read. Whether you agree with him or not, and most people won't 100%, including the most ardent Palestinian supporters, you cannot deny the fact that Finkelstein has an informed and undeniably unique perspective on most things. We are all here today for different reasons. Some of us are here because we love Professor Norman Finkelstein, and some of us are here because we dislike him. The controversy seems to follow Dr. Norman Finkelstein. Just a few days ago, in a review in the Foreword on the documentary American Radical, Finkelstein was described to have a quote-unquote disease. The article went on to say that he hates himself, and those who made him is a bruised apple full of a poison in the grip of a great force that is compelling to him to do and say strange things, thoughtfully titled A Jewish Finkelstein. But the question arises, and you can all be the judge today, is Norman Finkelstein really that controversial? Is anything he says overtly hateful without reason, or is he simply a man who is passionate against those who exploit suffering and the lives of others for their own gain? He campaigns with international law and is an academic and meticulous scholar. He leaves no details out, a man of scholarship, fervor, and passion are the qualities that describe Dr. Norman Finkelstein. And you may dislike what he has to say, you may even hate him for it, but it is impossible to deny the fact that he is an intelligent scholar who has done more justice than most of us can dream to do. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Norman Finkelstein.
Next to his own. And that's leaving aside his bravery and his courage and his sincerity and his intelligence, which are also tough tacks to follow. He told me he's starting college this year and going to SOAS, the School of Oriental and Nations Studies in the UK. And I have a feeling Jody is going to soon have a television program. That's my prediction. Now, whether he'll invite me on his program when he has it, I'm not sure. We'll wait and see. I'm going to speak today on what happened in Gaza about a year and a half ago. In December, began December 27, 2008, and it ended 22 days later, January 17th, 2009, January 18th, 2009. Now, maybe it would seem a kind of peculiarity. Why are we talking about Gaza a year and a half later? Wars come and go in the Middle East with such rapidity and with such frequency that one barely remembers what happened 2 or 3 weeks before. And yet, it's now nearly a year and a half since the Gaza invasion, and it doesn't seem to want to go away. It's a ghost that Israel can't seem to bury. It's a shadow which Israel can't seem to evade. And that's one of the questions I'd like to look at this evening. Why won't Gaza go away? What is it about what happened there that seems to live and to endure even a year and a half later? Before I look at what happened in Gaza, I want to look at what preceded it, the build-up, the run-up to the Israeli invasion. It's always arbitrary when we're going to begin any kind of chronology. I'll begin with January 2006, when the Palestinians in the occupied territories, in their parliamentary elections, brought into power Hamas, the Islamic movement. According to Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, the elections were completely honest and fair. His quote, "Israel, backed by the United States, reacted to those completely honest and fair elections by imposing economic sanctions on the people of Gaza." In January 2007, the United States, Israel, and some elements among the Palestinians attempted a coup to overthrow the legally elected government in Gaza. In the United States, that's known as democracy promotion. Well, Hamas foiled the coup, sent the Palestinians packing to the West Bank, and effectively took full control of Gaza. The Israelis and the Americans weren't pleased by Hamas's reaction, and so they tightened the economic blockade of Gaza. Amnesty International now weighed in, and it said this blockade, and I'm quoting Amnesty, is a flagrant violation of international law. The Goldstone Report, to which I'll return presently, the Goldstone Report called this blockade a possible crime against humanity. The former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, she journeyed to Gaza during these months, and she said, "Gaza's whole civilization has been destroyed. I'm not exaggerating. Its whole civilization has been destroyed." In June 2008, Hamas and Israel entered into a ceasefire that was brokered by Egypt. Each side had its obligations. On the Hamas side, they were obliged to cease their rocket and mortar attacks on Israel. On the Israeli side, they were obliged to lift the blockade of Gaza, that flagrant violation of international law, which was destroying a civilization. According to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and now I'm quoting it, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. There were some what Israel called rogue terrorist organizations, not Hamas, but others in Gaza, which were reluctant to honor the ceasefire, But Israeli documents state, and now I'm quoting them again, Hamas enforced the ceasefire on their rogue terrorist organizations with a great deal, although not complete success. So Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. But Israel reneged on its obligation to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza. Well, what happened next? To learn what happened next, all you have to do is open up the Amnesty International yearbook for 2008. Here's what Amnesty had to say. A ceasefire agreed in June between Israel and Palestinian armed groups in Gaza held for 4.5 months, but broke down after Israeli forces killed 6 Palestinian militants in airstrikes and other attacks on November 4th. So Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel reneged on its obligation to lift the blockade. And then Israel waited until November 4th, our election day, when the media and the public were riveted to the results of the historic election. And on that day, when the attention of the Americans was turned away, Israel went into Gaza and broke the ceasefire by killing several Palestinian militants. The ceasefire broke down, rockets started flying from Gaza, but Hamas kept saying, we want to renew the ceasefire. We want to renew the ceasefire. So long as Israel implements its obligations under the terms, that is, gradually lift the blockade. Israel said no. Hamas's cessation of rocket and mortar fire has to be unconditional and unilateral. In December 2008, Sarah Roy, the Harvard political economist, who's also the world's leading authority in the Gaza economy, and in a personal note, is the daughter of a survivor of Auschwitz concentration camp, Sarah Roy wrote, the breakdown of an entire society is happening in front of us, in Gaza. But there is little international response beyond UN warnings, which are ignored. So now Hamas was faced with two stark options. One, to acquiesce in their starvation. Or two, to fight, to resist. Hamas opted for resistance, although largely symbolic resistance. The former Israeli commander in Gaza, said at the end of December, you cannot just land blows, leave the Palestinians in Gaza and the economic distress therein, and expect that Hamas would just sit around and do nothing, said the former Israeli commander in Gaza. The head of Hamas during the Israeli invasion, he said, our modest homemade rockets are our cry of protest to the world. And what were those rocketed firing of rockets, except a plea to an indifferent world, a plea that said, SOS, we're dying. SOS, we're dying. It's easy enough to condemn the Hamas rocket and mortar attacks that ensued. But it seems to me those who condemn Hamas are under an obligation to spell out what other option they had. Otherwise, these critics are in effect saying that the people of Gaza had a legal moral obligation to just lie still and die. In any event, on December 27th, Israel launched its invasion of Gaza. And the invasion lasted for 22 days. But Amnesty International called the 22 days of death and destruction. We're told nowadays that what happened in Gaza was a war. There was a war in Gaza. I opened up a publication a couple of days ago. Actually, I think I have it here. Yeah, by coincidence, really coincidence. I opened up a publication by a respected human rights organization, and it is decent. It's called Turning a Blind Eye, Impunity for Laws of War Violations During the Gaza War. Well, even Human Rights Watch, it says there was a war in Gaza. And Israel attempted to justify the death and destruction by pointing to the fact, well, we were involved in a war. And as everybody knows, in wars, innocents get killed and places get unintentionally targeted. Israel said, we have to fight an asymmetrical war against those perfidious Hamas terrorists. Israel said we were faced with the fog of war conditions. Lots of confusion in the battlefield, instantaneous decisions that have to be made. So inevitably, there is death and destruction. But that argument, that claim, that is premised on one basic fact, that there was a war in Gaza. But was there a war in Gaza? After those 22 days, the Israeli leaders were very proud of themselves, and they started to boast that now we have shown the Arabs who's who and what's what. Because Israel suffered a devastating defeat in Lebanon in July and August 2006. And the Israelis began to fear that they were losing their deterrence capacity. Deterrence capacity is one of those fancy words coined by academics to intimidate you. All it means is the capacity to inspire fear of Israel in the Arab world. And the Israeli leaders were worried that after the defeat inflicted on Israel by Hezbollah in Lebanon, that the Arab world no longer feared Israel. And as some of you will know, the leader of Hezbollah, Sheikh Nasrallah, he never tired of reminding the Israelis that they had been defeated in Lebanon and that the Arabs are no longer afraid of Israel. And he even taunted the Israelis and said, come on, attack again, and we'll defeat you again. So now after Gaza, the Israelis began to boast that we've now shown the Arabs who's in charge because we won the war in Gaza. We won the war. But then along came an Israeli strategic analyst, and he said, it is very dangerous for Israel to believe it won the war when there was no war. In reality, not a single battle was fought during the 22 days of fighting. A former Israeli foreign ministry official said there was no war. Hamas sat in its bunkers and came out when it was all over. So what did happen in Gaza? We have a pretty clear picture of what happened in the battlefield. In the first week, Israel launched its air assault on Gaza. And by the end of the 22 days, it had launched 3,000 combat machines over Gaza. All 3,000 planes came back. None were down. None were even harmed. Well, that's not too surprising, because the Palestinians had no anti-aircraft defenses to speak of. It took as much courage to fly a combat mission over Gaza as it does to fly, as it does to shoot a fish in a barrel. After the air assault, Israel launched, at the beginning of the second week, its ground air assault in Gaza. The IDF, the Israeli military, they were equipped with special night fighting technology. Hamas couldn't even see them. So what happened in Gaza? Well, we have a pretty clear picture because after those 22 days, many Israeli soldiers came forward and testified to their experiences. And here's what the soldiers have to say. Soldier, there was nothing there, ghost towns, except for some livestock, nothing moved. Soldier, most of the time it was boring. There were not really too many events. Soldier, I did not see one single Arab the whole time we were there, that whole week. Soldier, everyone was disappointed about not engaging anyone. Soldier, usually we did not see a living soul, except for our soldiers, of course, not a soul. Soldier, go ahead and ask the other soldiers how often they encountered combatants in Gaza. Nothing, no one. Soldier, there was supposed to be a tiny resistance force upon entry. There just wasn't. No battles, no enemy in the field, no tangling with a foe. But that's only half of the story. For the other half, you should check for yourselves. All you have to do is go to your computer and enter the words breaking the silence in your Google. And up will come a document, a collection of testimonies from Israeli soldiers. And then the search function, just enter the word insane. Insane. And you'll see it comes up once, twice, three, four, five, six, seven. Insane, insane, insane. One soldier after another. They weren't in a group together. They were interviewed separately. But the same word left her mind. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. One soldier said, this was firepower such as I had never known. There were blasts all the time. The earth was constantly shaking. Another soldier said, on the ground you hear these thunderous blasts all day long. I mean, not just tank shelling, which is a term we've long gotten used to, but blasts that actually rock the outpost. To the extent that some of us were ordered out of the house, we were quartered in for fear it would collapse. The Israelis commandeered Palestinian homes. They were firing into the horizon. The ground right beneath their feet were shaking from these insane amounts of firepower. And they were told to abandon the houses because the houses might collapse right on them. So what did happen in Gaza? Actually, the soldiers themselves came up with the best metaphors. One soldier said, it felt like hunting season had begun. Sometimes it reminded me of PlayStation computer game. Another soldier said, you feel like a child playing around with a magnifying glass, burning up ants. It felt like a child playing around with a magnifying glass, burning up ants. I was a kid once, and I do recall, with no pride, but I do recall a magnifying glass focusing the sun's rays on an anthill and burning the ants, turning turning them into crispy critters. But I wasn't so delusional that I thought I was engaged in a war with the ants. In fact, the metaphor, the child in the magnifying glass burning ants, is very precise. One of Israel's tools of the trade is the use of white phosphorus. And I have read many times about Israel dropping white phosphorus, but I've actually never looked at the details of what white phosphorus was. This time I read a report by Human Rights Watch called Rain of Fire, and it said that the white phosphorus reaches a temperature of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, 800 degrees centigrade, 816 degrees Celsius. Well, 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. As Oprah would say, try wrapping your mind around that. But what did Israel do with the white phosphorus? Human Rights Watch said, now I'm quoting HRW, Israel repeatedly exploded white phosphorus munitions in the air over populated areas, killing and injuring civilians and damaging civilian structures. It dropped the white phosphorus in a school, a market, a humanitarian aid warehouse, and in hospitals. It dropped the white phosphorus in Al-Quds Hospital. They dropped the white phosphorus in Al-Wafa Hospital. Human Rights Watch said the hospitals were clearly marked, and there does not appear to have been fighting in that immediate area. By the end of those 22 days, 1,400 Palestinians had been killed, of whom up to four-fifths were civilians. 358 were children. On the Israeli side, there were 13 Israelis killed, 10 were combatants, and of those 10 combatants, half were killed by other Israelis by accident, friendly fire. So, for every 100 Palestinians killed, one Israeli was killed. For every 400 Palestinian civilians killed, one Israeli civilian was killed. 100 to 1. 400 to 1. That's not a war. That's a massacre. Every time you repeat that what happened in Gaza was a war, you wittingly or unwittingly become an instrument of Israeli propaganda. There was no war in Gaza. It was a slaughter, a bloodbath, a massacre in Gaza. After those 22 days, Israel desperately tried to justify some of its most egregious acts. So, Israel damaged or destroyed 29 ambulances, half of Gaza's health facilities, including 15 hospitals. Israel claimed, well, you know, Hamas, you know, those fanatic, crazy, cowardly Muslims. They were using the hospitals as refuge for their leadership. The human rights organizations investigated the charge. Amnesty International investigated the charge. The Dugard Committee, the Goldstone Mission, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights in Israel, an independent team of medical experts, they all investigated. They all reached the same conclusion. There's just no evidence, there's none at all, that Hamas was using the hospitals as a refuge for their militants. What about the ambulances? Israel claims the ambulances were being used to carry Hamas terrorists and weapons. All the human rights organizations investigated, all of them came to the same conclusion. There's no evidence. Even Israel's own National Emergency Medical Disaster and Ambulance Service, Magen David Adom. It testified, and now I'm quoting it, there was no use of Palestinian Red Crescent Society ambulances for the transport of weapons or ammunition. Israel destroyed 30 mosques, damaged 15 more. The Goldstone Mission, which, as I said, I'll return, they investigated the case of one mosque that they called an intentional Israeli attack on a mosque that killed at least 15 people attending service. What did the Goldstone Mission find? I'm quoting it. There is no evidence that this mosque was used for the storage of weapons or any military activity by Palestinian armed groups. No evidence. Well, as Israel said, in other cases, mosques were being used to store weapons. But there's still a problem, because Israel systematically targeted the minarets in Gaza. The minarets in Gaza are very narrow. They don't contain staircases. So it was impossible to use the minarets as for snipers or for surveillance. Why did Israel target the minarets? The Dugard Committee, John Dugard is a distinguished South African jurist. He's considered the father of human rights in South Africa, or human rights legislation in South Africa. He said, now I'm quoting him, the mosques, and more particularly the minarets, had been targeted on the grounds that they symbolized Islam. Well, that's a good reason. You can't quarrel with that. But some of you might be thinking, omitting a crucial fact, rather larger than a detail, namely, don't we all know that Hamas is using Palestinians as human shields, hiding behind them in typically cowardly Islamic Muslim fanatic style? And Israel had no choice but to target civilians, because Hamas was using them as human shields. How many of you have heard that? Raise your hand. Hi. So we can see it. But you have to be suffering from a degenerative brain disease not to have heard that, or an excessive consumption of mind-altering drugs. It was all over the place. But it happened. Amnesty International did a very careful investigation, Amnesty being the most respected human rights organization in the world. Here's what Amnesty found. Contrary to repeated allegations by Israeli officials of the use of human shields, Amnesty International found no evidence that Hamas or other Palestinian fighters directed the movement of civilians to shield military objectives from attack. Amnesty International found no evidence that Hamas or other armed groups forced residents to stay in or around buildings used by fighters. Amnesty International found no evidence that fighters prevented residents from leaving buildings or areas which had been commandeered by militants. It never happened. Now, how many of you are aware that the main human rights organizations, in their investigations, found no evidence that Hamas engaged in human shielding? Raise your hand. Well, look around. That's the problem. Everybody knows the Israeli propaganda, which is peddled by our media, but nobody knows what the human rights organizations and their investigations actually found. Even if it were true that Hamas engaged in human shielding, it could not explain the death in Gaza. Why? Well, let's see what Amnesty had to say. Amnesty said the attacks that caused the greatest number of fatalities and injuries were of people who were not caught in the crossfire of battles. Many were killed when their homes were bombed while they slept. Others were going about their daily activities in their homes, sitting in their yard, hanging the laundry on the roof when they were targeted in airstrikes and tank shelling. How did the children die? The 358 children. The children were studying or playing in their bedrooms or on the roof or outside their homes when they were struck by missiles or tank shells. It's not true, of course, that there was no human shielding in Gaza. That would be an exaggeration. In fact, it would be an outright falsehood. There was a lot of human shielding. It was extensively documented. It was Israeli soldiers using Palestinians as human shields. All the human rights reports, missions, and investigations concluded that Israel committed multiple war crimes and possibly or definitely crimes against humanity. They also concluded that Hamas committed comparable crimes, but on an incomparably smaller scale. How many crimes can ants commit against a child, incinerating them with a magnifying glass? In April 2009, the United Nations Human Rights Council commissioned an investigative body to find out what happened in Gaza. And they appointed as the head of this mission a fellow named Richard Goldstone, an eminent international jurist. He was the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda. And soon thereafter, Mr. Goldstone released a very large report, or I should say his mission released a very large report. It ran to some 500 pages, and it had some pretty devastating conclusions. It stated, and now I'm quoting it, that Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population in Gaza. A deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, terrorize, and humiliate. Punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Its second main conclusion was, what happened in Gaza wasn't an accident. It wasn't a few Israeli soldiers who had gone berserk. What happened in Gaza was all premeditated, intentional, by the highest levels of Israeli society. Quote, the systematic and deliberate nature of the activities leave the mission no doubt that responsibility lies in the first place with those who designed, planned, ordered, and oversaw the operations. That is to say, Israel's political and military leaders. Well, it was very hard. It was very hard to deny Mr. Goldstone's conclusions, because before, during, and after the attack, the Israeli leaders were very open about what they intended to do, what they were doing, and afterwards, what they did do. The head of Israel's northern command, he said before the war, or before the massacre, we will yield disproportionate power against every village from which shots are fired in Israel and cause immense damage and destruction. Before the attack, the former chief of Israel's National Security Council said, the next war will lead to intense suffering among the enemy population, the destruction of homes and infrastructure, and the suffering of hundreds of thousands of people. During the attack, Israel's foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, she said, Hamas now understands that when you fire at Israel's citizens, it responds by going wild. And that is a good thing. The day after the attack, Foreign Minister Livni, she appeared on the Channel 10 News in Israel. And she said, Israel demonstrated real hooliganism during the course of the recent operation, which is what I demanded. Then there's Livni, the foreign minister. She goes to the UK a few months later, and some citizens present her with papers alleging that she's a war criminal. And there's Livni shocked. She's bewildered. She can't understand. She's certain that real hooliganism was protected by the Geneva Conventions. A former Israeli defense official said afterwards, with an armada of fighter planes attacking Gaza, Israel decided to play the role of a mad dog for the sake of its deterrence capacity. A former senior Israeli security official boasted, Israel had regained its deterrence capacity because it has shown Hamas, Iran, and the region that it can be as lunatic as any of them. Lunatic. Mad dogs. Real hooliganism. Wild. Immense and intense suffering. What else was the Goldstone mission supposed to conclude? Except that Israel used disproportionate force designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population, and that it was the Israeli leadership that presided over all of this. As many of you know, the Goldstone mission, or the Goldstone report, and Goldstone himself became the target of a huge campaign of vilification across the Israeli political spectrum. The Israeli president, Shimon Peres, the Nobel laureate for peace, Peres said that the report was a mockery of history, and Goldstone was a small man devoid of any sense of justice. And then the Nobel laureate for peace, Mr. Peres, proceeded to set the record straight for those who suffer from illusions and confusions. So, is anybody here from the West Bank? Raise your hand. So Mr. Peres clarified what happened. He said, Israeli military operations are what brought economic prosperity to the West Bank. Anyone here from Lebanon? Good. So Mr. Peres clarified what happened during July, August 2006. He said that Israel liberated Lebanon from the wrath of Hezbollah. That clarifies that. Anyone here from Gaza? Well, most of you know the record. There's one young woman in the back. So what happened during those 22 days, he said? Israeli military operations enabled Gaza residents to return to their daily routine. Thank you very much. The Israeli ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, some people think he's a historian, Mr. Oren said that the Goldstone report was even worse than Ahmadinejad and the Holocaust deniers. And that's pretty bad. Back in the United States, Alan Dershowitz at Harvard Law School, he said that the Goldstone report is so filled with lies, distortions, and blood libels that it could have been drafted by Hamas extremists. That the report recalled the protocols of the elders of Zion. He accused Goldstone of being an evil man, an absolute traitor. And as we know from the Sinclair Lewis novel, Elmer Gantry, every circus needs a clown. So Elie Wiesel entered the scene, and he said the Goldstone report is a crime against the Jewish people. A lot of people are very angry with Goldstone. Some of you may know that today it was reported that Goldstone would not be able to attend his grandson's bar mitzvah because of threatened demonstrations by the South African Zionist Federation. The really interesting question is, what accounts for the hysterical reaction to the Goldstone Report? Because the Goldstone Report was the last in a long series of reports by respected human rights organizations and individuals condemning Israeli action. Amnesty International put out 2 reports, very substantial. Human Rights Watch put out 5 reports. This last one will make it 6. And then Palestinian human rights organizations, Israeli human rights organizations, independent international missions, committees, investigatory bodies. The Goldstone Report fell squarely in line in its findings with all the other reports. In fact, it was probably the most cautious, the most circumspect, the most judicious of all the reports. So why the hysteria with the Goldstone Report? The answer is not too hard to find. Richard Goldstone is not only Jewish, but he's a self-declared Zionist. He says, I work for Israel all my adult life. I fully support Israel's right to exist. I'm a firm believer in the absolute right of the Jewish people to have their home there. Mr. Goldstone sits on the Board of Governors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He received an honorary degree from the Hebrew University. His mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. His daughter is Zionist Aliyah. Can we correct that? Okay, no problem. His daughter is Zionist Aliyah to Israel. Goldstone asked why he became an international human rights lawyer. He said, well, I was inspired to go into this field because of the Nazi Holocaust. Well, now Israel had a very big problem in these hands. Because for 30 years, Israel had honed these weapons, perfected these weapons, in order to neutralize any criticism of Israel, in order to discredit any critics of Israel. So if you criticize Israel, you have to be an anti-Semite, or you have to be a self-hating Jew, or you have to be a Holocaust denier. But Mr. Goldstone's person, he neutralized all those weapons of Israel. As the Israeli columnist Gideon Levin put it, this time the messenger is propaganda proof. Mr. Goldstone, he doesn't seem like a typical anti-Semite. He doesn't have a typical profile of a self-hating Jew. He's a Zionist. I love Israel. He doesn't seem to be a Holocaust denier. He said it was the Holocaust that inspired me to go into human rights law. Well, if Goldstone was not an anti-Semite, he was not a self-hating Jew, if he wasn't a Holocaust denier, if he was neither an incompetent nor a fool, and the former chief prosecutor of Yugoslavia and Rwanda tribes couldn't be an incompetent or a fool, and the only plausible explanation for Mr. Goldstone's conclusions, the only plausible explanation is they were true. Which is why Israel panicked and continues to this day to panic. There are many important repercussions of the Goldstone Report. I'll limit myself to one, which is that the Goldstone phenomenon, if you can call it that, it registers and it catalyzes the breakup of liberal Jewish support for Israel. Mr. Goldstone is a fairly typical classical Jew. He's a defender of the rule of law, human rights. And most American Jews are liberal in that sense. 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama. Even among Latinos, the percentage was significantly lower. It was 67%. Among whites in general, it was about 43%. If you factor in that Jews are by far the wealthiest ethnic group in the United States, they should have been voting overwhelmingly Republican. But no, 80% of Jews voted for Obama. because Jews are liberal. And being liberal generally means believing in the rule of law, believing in international institutions, supporting human rights. Amnesty International, it's a liberal organization. Human Rights Watch, it's a liberal organization. And the basic fact is, nowadays, it's simply impossible any longer to call yourself a liberal and to defend Israeli policy, especially when the main critics of Israeli policy are respected human rights organizations and the person of Goldstone, eminent human rights activists. And it seems almost certain that the Goldstone phenomenon reflects the breakup, the gradual disintegration of Jewish support for Israel. And then that leaves us with the important question, the way Mr. Jobe ended, which is, what should we do? Because there are real possibilities now. There's real potential now for us to reach outside a fairly narrow group of people and reach deeply into the public and organize a real public opposition to what Israel is doing. And I think we have to think very hard and give some real thought, real reflection to how we proceed now. Because now we really don't have an excuse that everybody is against us, that it's hopeless, it's pointless. No, it's no longer true. In fact, I would say on any given college campus, I would much prefer to be defending the Palestinian cause than the Israeli cause. The Israeli cause is very hard to defend on college campuses. It's a real embarrassment. Who wants to go around wearing t-shirts and drop white phosphorus in hospitals? It doesn't fly in college campuses. So we have no excuse. We have a real possibility now, and we have to think hard, and we have to be careful and cautious about the kinds of language we use, the kinds of goals we set, to make sure that we don't end up alienating our potential allies. And that's a serious mandate for us. Some people want to turn whether or not you're a Zionist into a litmus test of whether or not you're in our camp or not in our camp. Well, if you use that standard, whether or not you're a Zionist, you're excluding Richard Goldstone from our camp because he says he's a Zionist. Is that smart? Is that wise? Is that how we break out of our ghetto and into the mainstream? My own view, it would take too much time now to go into in detail, but we should take as our, if I could use the word inspiration, Mr. Gandhi, who I know fairly well now, not from Hollywood and not from YouTube, but from having gone through a large part of his collective works, which are pretty substantial. There are 100 volumes, and each volume is 500 pages. Gandhi wrote a lot. It happens that most of what he wrote was about diet and home cures for various illnesses and disabilities. If you have a problem with constipation or impotence, you can find a cure in Gandhi's collected works. But of course, he had a lot to say about politics, and he called his nonviolent movement, he called it Satyagraha. What does Satyagraha mean? There are some Indians in this room. So what does Satyagraha mean? Or how would he translate it? Yes?
Holding on to truth.
Beautiful. I didn't think you were Indian. Very deceptive. Typical old side. He translates Satyagraha as hold on to the truth. And that's our challenge, to hold on to the truth that what Israel has done to the Palestinians is wrong. And it's indefensible. And to hold on to the truth that a diplomatic settlement of the conflict is possible. And it's only Israel backed by the United States which is preventing a diplomatic settlement of the conflict. If we learn how to wield the weapon of truth, as it's recorded in the findings of the human rights community, and if we learn how to wield the weapon of justice, as it's embodied in the uncontroversial principles of international law, and I would stress uncontroversial, as Jolie said, it's uncontroversial in international law. East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. It is uncontroversial under international law that the settlements are illegal. And we have to learn to wield that weapon. The first way to learn how to wield it is to know it, to know what the International Court of Justice is ruling, to know what human rights organizations have said. If we learn how to wield the weapons of truth and justice, and we show a little fortitude, and I must admit, being deeply humbled by the pictures of Mr. Jolie in his wheelchair in the clouds of tear gas, if we learn how to wield the weapons of truth and justice and show a little fortitude in the settlement of the Israel-Palestine conflict, I think it is well within reach. Thank you.